KPCC's podcasts are supported by Harvey Mudd College, where engineering, science, and mathematics are informed by the liberal arts. Students and faculty working together to solve problems and serve society. Online at hmc.edu.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Grab your voter pamphlet or your sample ballot if you want to make notes about the ballot propositions and the local measures. We're going to take you through them during this hour of Air Talk. We're delighted to be joined by the Chief Executive Officer of the Center for Governmental Studies, which is a nonpartisan nonprofit designed to help people better understand the issues of governance and election law, as well as election issues. With us is Tracy Weston. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate
to be here.
It. Have a lot to talk about today. We're just going to run down numerically in order on the ballot, but we can go back to ones with your phone calls. If you have questions about any of these initiatives or local measures, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. There are even different thresholds for passage of some of these. If it's a property tax, for example, it has to have a two-thirds margin, otherwise it doesn't go into effect. If it's a bond measure, 55% is the threshold, and if it's not one that has to do with that level of financial commitment, a simple majority will typically do. 866-893-KPCC. Well, speaking of financial one, the first one is a high-speed rail bond measure, Proposition 1A, which would set aside nearly $10 billion to be used for construction of a high-speed train to go not less than 205 miles an hour, I believe, is the speed threshold on that train, connecting Northern and Southern California and also offering some local transit options within those parts of the state. So, Tracy, your thoughts on this one, sort of who's in favor of it and who's against?
Well, this has been put on the ballot by the legislature. They've been studying it for 8 to 10 years, so this is not a quickie that's been thrown up by one individual. It's gotten a lot of study. It does require $10 billion in bonds, but it also requires matching from federal and local and private funds before the state bonds are spent. So there's a kind of a guarantee that that if they don't get matching to raise enough money to pay for the whole thing, then the bond monies won't be spent. They're also anticipating that once ridership gets up, it'll be fairly vigorous, and they'll be able to make that money back in $1 billion a year in rider revenues and so forth. And they also predict that it'll create a lot of jobs in the state and so forth and so on. Now, obviously, people in the construction industries are for this. A lot of people who are train buffs love the idea. It copies what's been done in Europe. The no side generally says it's too much and this is the wrong time. We're facing a financial crisis in the state. We're having trouble paying for our bills right now. Let's not throw another $10 billion at it. The rebuttal to that, I suppose, is the money really won't be spent until the matching comes in. And in the long term, it's an infrastructure investment in the state that will help everyone.
This is one of two measures that Los Angeles County residents will be seeing pertaining to transit. The other is a half-cent sales tax proposal, which we will get to a little bit later. That is County Measure R, put on the ballot by the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. But we continue with the state measures. And again, if you have any questions about these, we're at 866-893-KPCC, or you can blog your comments on the AirTalk blog at kpcc.org. Also on Proposition 1A, the opponents of that, one of the points they raise is they're questioning the numbers and whether this, in fact, would pay for the system, even with the matches that the proponents claim. Proposition 2, you've seen tons of television ads on this. This largely has to do with hens and whether they would be able to move in larger cages, be able to turn around or stand up, or whether they would be free range out of doors. This is a proposal to allow for certain farm animals, including egg-laying hens, to have more space. Tell us more about it, Tracy Weston.
Well, California raises 40 million animals a year, and as you said, this proposal would prohibit certain forms of cruelty to animals by giving them space to stand up, turn around, stretch their wings. Essentially, this applies to egg-laying chickens. We really don't have much of a a pork or a veal industry in California. The proponents argue this will only increase costs of about a penny an egg, and that's worth it to protect chickens and let them live in reasonably humane environments. The opponents essentially argue that this will force egg production out of California and that it won't solve the problem, that all the eggs will simply come in from Arizona or even Mexico.
Because they can undercut the price.
That's right. The rebuttal to that is it's not so easy to move, the costs are not that great, and in fact, many egg producers are already meeting these standards. So the rebuttal argument is this will only affect a small number. The rebuttal to that is that California law already prevents cruelty in animals. They must provide adequate exercise, and the solution is simply enforce that law, not impose these cumbersome requirements on egg producers. The supporters generally are Humane Society, Center for Food Safety, Center for Public
Interest.
They
actually put it on the ballot, the Humane,
right.
National Humane,
right.
Society.
There have been arguments that this will increase dangerous food. That seems to have been rebutted by most of the food safety experts. So really it is a question of treating animals humanely versus potentially greater costs on producers and driving them out of state.
That's Proposition 2 on your California state ballot. Proposition 3 is a $980 million bond measure with the funds going to children's hospitals. 20%, I believe, of the money would be set aside for University of California Children's Hospitals. Tracy Weston, there's not really organized opposition to this per se, but there are the usual taxpayers groups who believe that more bonded indebtedness is a bad thing.
Yes. We have approved in 2004 Proposition 61, which authorized $750 million in government obligation bonds for children hospitals. And now, in a sense, this is another one. So some of the opponents have said, look, why two in a row? We haven't even spent all the money in the first one. Most of this goes to either state hospitals or private nonprofit hospitals. The money's dedicated for children's surgery, things like that. One of the reasons that they've come back, apparently, is that because these children's hospitals have to treat so many uninsured children or children who are on Medi-Cal and the reimbursements are very low, they're having trouble even meeting their costs. So they want to increase the facilities and begin to treat children instead of having them go to emergency rooms.
This would specifically go for capital projects and equipment that would be used for these children's hospitals. Again, it's $980 million in bonds, and the cost to repay it over 30 years would be approximately $2 billion, according to the State Legislative Analyst's Office. Proposition 4 is another initiative that deals with a waiting period for minors who are seeking an abortion and a mandate that the minor's parent or guardian, if they're an unemancipated minor, be informed during that 48-hour cooling off period, if you will. This somewhat similar to the one that was turned down by voters, what was it, a couple years ago?
Yeah, actually, there have been two very similar measures on recent ballots. They've both been turned down. This is the third time around. They've adjusted primarily, I think, their advertising campaign. The measure itself is very similar. But as you said, it would say that unemancipated minors who are females under 18, not married, not on active military duty, would have to wait 48 hours while the doctor notifies their parents. Now, the parents don't get to say no. I mean, they can't prevent the abortion. They can say no, but they can't prevent the abortion, but they have to be notified. Now, there are certain exceptions for medical emergencies, which are defined fairly narrowly, for notifying an adult relative if there's some problem with sex abuse from the parent and so forth. And they can also go to court. The difficulty with this, the opponents say, is that it forces some young girls into a very difficult choice. If they notify the court or notify the doctor that the pregnancy is a result of parental abuse or some abuse in the family, they have to turn that family member over to the police so that the girl is under this choice. Do I notify or have my parent or somebody go to jail?
Which the proponents say is a good thing because they say it's important if a girl is being abused that mm-hmm. be made public. And opponents say, but yeah, that could actually threaten the life of the girl in some cases.
Right. The strong message from the proponents of this is that it will help reduce sexual predators. The argument being that if a sexual predator knows that his identity will be disclosed, he presumably will not be a predator as much as he otherwise would be. And that's been disputed by the opponents. So
That's Proposition 4, initiative waiting period and parental notification before termination of a minor's pregnancy. We're with Tracy Weston, the CEO of the Center for Governmental Studies. It's your ballot primer. If you got it in hand or easily accessible, we're talking through a synopsis of each of these so that you can hopefully make your choice tomorrow when you go into the polling booth.
I will say on Propositions 3 and 4, the Center for Governmental Studies, together with the California Healthcare Foundation, has created a website, healthvote.org, which goes into considerable detail on Propositions 3 and 4 from an objective and balanced point of view. So that will
That's
get, those
great.
Sites will give everything you want to know.
Terrific. That's the Children's Hospital Bond Act 3 and the waiting period before abortion granting is number 4. Proposition 5 is backed by George Soros. The billionaires put a lot of money into various political causes. It's aimed at nonviolent drug offenses, sentencing, parole, and rehabilitation. The initiative allocates $460 million a year to improve and expand treatment programs, but it would cause a number of these cases to be treated differently than they are now in the court system, Tracy.
Yeah, this is a very complicated and detailed measure. Obviously, a lot of his thought has gone into it. The core idea here is to stop warehousing people who are caught with drugs and who are addicts by putting them in prison and instead channel them into a series of rehabilitation programs. And the money goes to pump up those rehabilitation programs. The proponents argue this will also save $2.5 billion a year because we won't have to build all these prisons. A very large percentage of people in prisons are there for drug-related expenses. There are many provisions in here. It expands drug treatment programs. It creates a three-track system in which you go to one-track, two-track, three-track. It reduces some parole terms. It increases some parole terms. It promotes rehabilitation. It decriminalizes to a certain extent possession of marijuana within 28.5 grams. It treats it like a traffic ticket. And so the general idea is to get people into rehabilitation program. The opponents are very concerned about this, including law enforcement, because they argue, among other things, that people on drugs need the shock of incarceration. They need that clarifying moment in which they realize they've hit rock bottom, and that these – by putting them into rehabilitation programs, the seriousness of what they've done never really sinks in. The LA Times has come out against this. It says that, for example, an addict who is caught breaking into a house, for example, might not have to go to a jail as long as he says that it was caused by my addiction. So they're afraid that people will get off
criminal penalties. Use that as an excuse.
Right, use that as an excuse.
There's another issue that opponents have raised, and that is that their argument, typically the people that are serving time, at least in the state facilities, have quantities that go along with being drug traffickers, not just people in possession of drugs, because there's already the Prop 36 option and drug courts that are available. So their perspective is that this would essentially allow people who are involved in the trafficking of drugs to be able to avoid serving sentences for that. We'll continue on this because it is a complicated measure. We also have a listener call who wants to ask about Proposition 5, state measure you'll be voting on tomorrow when you go to the polls if you've not already voted by mail. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
Trust and reliability are always important qualities, but especially now. You trust and rely on KPCC and NPR for news that matters, for news that affects your life. Your financial support makes that news possible and keeps it coming every day. Please make a contribution now. It takes just a couple of minutes to do your part at kpcc.org. Thanks.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by UCLA Live, presenting the North American premiere of The Blue Dragon by Canadian director and actor Robert Lepage. Featuring Lepage in his LA performance debut, The Blue Dragon explores the clash of Eastern and Western values in modern-day China. 11 performances only, opening November 12th at Froude Playhouse. Information at UCLALive.org. Just when you thought election season was ending, here's word that it isn't, at least in the city of L.A. KPCC Cheryl Duvall says candidates for several local offices have less than a week to file their intention to run in March.
More than half the seats on the L.A. City Council will factor into the spring election. So will at least three seats on the L.A. Unified School Board. Its two most senior members, Julie Korenstein and Marlene Cantor, are stepping down. Whoever wants to run for those offices, or for city attorney, city controller, four positions on the L.A. Community College District Board of Trustees, and, oh yes, mayor of Los Angeles, will have to file a declaration of intention to become a candidate. The deadline to file falls at noon on Saturday. That means Angelenos will have a whole new roster of contenders to get acquainted with as soon as the presidential and congressional campaigns have ended. Cheryl Duvall, 89.3 KPCC.
In the Sepulveda Pass right now, the 405 South Pass Valley Vista has a crash blocking the carpool and two left lanes. It's backing up toward the 101. It's 11:21.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the state and local ballot measures you'll be deciding on tomorrow. We invite your calls if you have questions about them at 866-893-5722, or you can blog your comment or question. The AirTalk blog at kpcc.org. The CEO of the Center for Governmental Studies, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization to help voters with just such decisions, Tracy Weston, is with us on the program, as is our listener, Dorit, in Silver Lake. You're on AirTalk.
Hi, Prop 5. I'm all ready to vote for yes on that. But the mailings I've been getting, and I hate to admit it, the commercials that I've been seeing where they say, like, violent criminals and drug dealers and other persons will get out because of Prop 5, if that's the truth, I'd vote no against it, but it does look good on paper. I'd like to hear off the air what everyone else thinks.
All right, and this is one where Dianne Feinstein, U.S. Senator, has also done a number of ads that have been in heavy rotation. Tracy Weston?
Well, in general, the provisions are complicated, but the thrust of the matter is not to put violent or potentially dangerous criminals into drug rehabilitation programs. The measure is fairly clear that if there's violence or gang or sexual abuse violations in this person's past, they're not put into this program. So they're fairly they're fairly careful to try and screen them out. Now, whether they're successful, that always remains to be seen.
Well, and what's a violent crime is also often in the eye of the beholder. I know that there are certain legal definitions, but, you know, some people a hot burglary where you're breaking into a house where someone's there, even though there may not be violence that ensues, is an inherently provocatively violent act.
Well, the LA Times is afraid that this would put people into treatment programs instead of jail who have engaged in spousal abuse or have driven under the influence and even injured someone. So you're right. There becomes an interpretive question of what's really bad. The measure tries to deal with this. It may not have done it totally successfully. I will say that a number of governors, in fact, it seems like most of them, Davis, Brown, Wilson and Duke Majan are all opposing this, as well as Governor Schwarzenegger. But people involved in humane corrections are supporting this. So it's a complicated measure.
All right, Dorit, hopefully that's helpful as you make your decision on this tomorrow. We move on to Proposition 6. This also having to do with law enforcement requires $965 million minimum of state funding each year for police and local law enforcement and makes revisions in about 30 cases of California criminal law. So a lot of money would go to local law enforcement as a part of this. Question is, of course, Tracy, where the state comes up with the money.
Right. Well, it does allocate close to $1 billion. However, it only increases the current allocation by about $365 million. So the net cost to the state is $365 million. Essentially, this is kind of takes the opposite tack of Prop 5, which is trying to keep people out of jail. This tries to put more people in jail. It increases penalties, makes about 30 changes in the criminal law, cracks down on gang penalties, imposes life for carjacking, extortion, extra 5 years in prison for recruiting 14-year-olds under to gangs, and so forth. It also expands admission of hearsay evidence. Some lawyers don't like that. The people for it believe that this will crack down more on crime, and law enforcement likes it because they're getting more money.
This is often referred to as son of three strikes, isn't it?
This is
very much, and the same people that supported three strikes very much supportive of this.
That's right. The no's, the people who are arguing against it, are afraid that it's, again, too expensive. It requires building $500 million in new prisons. That it, by increasing penalties, increases the jail population. And in some cases, that actually blocks spending on drug rehabilitation and mental health. So it's almost a countermeasure to a certain extent to Proposition 5.
All right. Again, this one has a number of different provisions, more dollars that would go to local law enforcement, and is a tough on crime approach in a number of categories of statutes. Coming up next is Proposition 7. This one requires government-owned utilities to generate 20% of their electricity from renewable energy by the year 2010. That's a standard currently applicable to private electrical corporations, and raises the requirement for all utilities to 40% renewable generation of electricity by 2020 and 50% by 2025. Tracy?
Well, this is a controversial measure. There are a lot of people on both sides of this. People have trouble making up their minds. Surprisingly, a number of environmental groups are against it. They're opposing it because they actually think it will force small wind and solar companies out of business. For instance, it requires the large utilities to get their energy increasingly from renewable sources, but it excludes small producers of under 30 megawatts. So they're afraid these small producers will be driven out of business. Some homeowners who are putting solar on their roofs and then pumping the unused electricity back into the system wouldn't get credit for that. It wouldn't help the utilities to receive that. So there's some concern about that. There's also some concern that this comes from an individual in Arizona and that maybe he has in mind very large solar plants in Arizona with the energy pumped in, so they're charges of self-interest. On the other hand, many people feel that the only way we're going to tackle global warming is to significantly increase the amounts of energy we receive from renewable sources. And without this kind of a push, it won't happen. And some there are very prominent people supporting this as well.
I guess David Freeman. Formerly the head of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and Tennessee Valley Authority before that, right. And now on the L.A. Harbor Commissioners.
But it's kind of ironic that you would see this environmental measure opposed by the California League of Conservation Voters, National Resource Defense Council, Environmental Defense Fund. So it's a very complicated and controversial measure.
Todd has blogged on the AirTalk blog, kpcc.org. He said, I've heard on Proposition 7 it would solidify loopholes, yet no one has said what these so-called loopholes are. What are they talking about? Because there are these timetables now, and maybe one of the loopholes they're talking about is the government-owned utilities getting a break that the private ones don't.
Well, they're both treated the same in terms of meeting the caps. However, with respect to the private utilities, there's a requirement in there that they don't have to take energy from renewable sources if the price is over 10% what the market rate is. Now, the market rate is set by the California Department of Environment, so that's a slightly subjective. But with respect to the government-owned utilities, they don't have to address that in a sense because as the prices go up, people have to pay for that anyway through taxes and so forth. So it's a complicated mix. Their argument is that there are loopholes. As often is the case, there are debates over what's a loophole.
All right. So that's Proposition 7, Renewable Energy Generation Initiative. Proposition 8, unless you've been in a cave somewhere, you undoubtedly know what this is about. This would essentially reverse the California Supreme Court decision from earlier in the year that allowed same-sex couples in California to marry over the past few months. So tomorrow you have a chance to vote on Proposition 8. It would amend California's Constitution and would say that same-sex couples will no longer have that right that had been given them by the state Supreme Court's rulings. This one, comparatively straightforward, given all the complexities of these other ones on energy and the like and criminal justice.
This is one of the easiest ones to read. I think it's about one sentence, so there's no difficulty in understanding what it does. The history is interesting. A measure like this was on the ballot in the year 2000, Prop 22, and the voters upheld it, prohibiting same-sex marriage. Then this year, the California Supreme Court reversed that by saying it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the California Constitution. So this now is a proposed constitutional amendment that would, in a sense, override the Supreme Court's judgment. The Proponents argue that it preserves the traditional concept of marriage and that it doesn't take away any rights from gays because they're protected already under California law. And they have also made the argument, which has been hotly rebutted by the experts in the field, that that it'll force sex education in preschool and even lower school grades and explain gay marriage, and they feel that should be left to the parents. The arguments against it essentially are that we got rid of separate but equal many years ago. This is another version of separate but equal. It's not really equal. That the only way to give people full dignity and rights under the law is to give them the rights to marry.
And that's, of course, how the California Supreme Court saw things, that you can't have two different categories, even if they essentially provide the same rights.
That's right.
That having that separate category is in and of itself discriminatory.
That's right. That was the core of the ruling.
So we'll see what happens tomorrow with California voters on Proposition 8. One thing that the opponents, or I should say supporters of 8, have claimed is that, you know, there wouldn't be any way for kids to opt out or parents to opt kids out of education about marriage or sex education ever. The law in California apparently is different and does allow for that, unlike Massachusetts.
It does allow, and there's as I understand it, nothing in this measure would change the existing situation. There already are some requirements of education. Parents can opt out. It's generally not done in very low grades, early grades anyway. Nothing would change. It's exactly the same as it's always been.
All right. Let's talk about Proposition 9. This one is a victims' rights initiative, and it would in many cases mean that someone coming up for a parole hearing would have to wait much longer before they would have that hearing. And it essentially mandates notification of victims or family members of victims in violent crimes who would then be able to take part in proceedings all the way along. This is an extension of victims' rights in California, Tracy.
Yes, it does overlap existing victims' rights. California does have fairly extensive provisions on victim rights. It repeats some of them and puts them into the Constitution. It adds some new ones, some notification to the victim, opportunities for input during a criminal proceeding at bail hearings, sentencing hearings, and so forth. It does order restitution in every case where the victim suffers a loss, and it does that before fines are paid to the government. So it means that certain, for instance, fish in California are protected by fines of certain sort, and they would begin to lose that revenue. So there's a kind of a trade-off there. It does extend the number of people who can testify at parole hearings. It tends to reduce attorneys at parole hearings. It extends the time between parole hearings. So in California, you get parole hearings from 1 to 5 years based on the crime. It would extend that to 3 to 15 years. And they argue that will reduce costs of attorneys and so forth and so on. The opponents say, yes, but it's going to increase incarceration costs and jail housing and so forth. That will go up. The opponents also argue that this will worsen overcrowded prisons, duplicates aspects of current law. We already have one of the strictest parole systems in the United States, and that because it puts it into the Constitution, it makes this complicated area that requires a lot of discretion very difficult to amend. Once it's in the Constitution, you need another constitutional amendment to change it.
Proponents, though, argue that on the issue of length between parole hearings, that someone, if they're going to be held for 15 more years before their next parole hearing, the crime is so heinous that that's the only reason why it's going to be held that many years into the future, and they wouldn't be getting out anyway.
Yeah. But again, although there are more frequent parole hearings, the state is very careful not to let people out. I mean, very few people actually get let out on parole early.
All right. This is Proposition 9 we're talking about. We move on to Proposition 10. It's another one that deals with alternative energy, with alternative fuel vehicles. $5 billion in bonds would be authorized that would be paid from the state's general fund to help consumers and others purchase certain kinds of vehicles to fund research in renewable energy and alternative fuel vehicles. Interestingly, despite all the emphasis on alternative energy and alternative fuel vehicles, this is largely being fought by environmental organizations.
Yes, that's right. The core of this, about three-fifths of this $5 billion, goes to rebates to consumers. So if consumers buy certain alternative fuel vehicles, they will get between a $2,000 and in some cases up to $50,000 rebate for big trucks and so forth. So the idea is that by giving consumers that rebate, they will go out and purchase alternative fuel vehicles and will create a market for them, and pollution and so forth will go down. Now, environmental groups say, look, this is primarily designed by Texas oil billionaire T. Boone Pickens to increase sales of natural gas, of which he controls a significant portion of. So it's going to benefit him. The rebuttal to that is, who cares if it benefits him as long as it helps consumers and reduces pollution? Others argue that you use bonds to invest in infrastructure, the way you buy a house. You get a loan and pay it back over a long term. But this doesn't build anything in California. It simply helps people get cars. And they're frankly switching to hybrids and low and increased fuel efficiency cars anyway, so you don't need these incentives to push them in that direction.
Well, the other argument I know that the opponents of 10 have made is that you'd have trucking companies who could purchase their fleets in California, get these very big rebates, but then take the trucks out of state. There'd be no net benefit to California's air quality, but state residents would be subsidizing the purchase of these trucks that would go elsewhere.
Right. Yes, I've heard that too. I couldn't say if that's true or not.
All right. Let's take a call from Scott in Santa Monica. You're on Air Talk.
Yeah, hi. Only T. Boone Pickens would do something like this. He's sponsoring the bill, and this bill is designed solely to enrich him. Under the wording of the proposition itself, you do not have to buy another truck to get a credit. Your existing truck will get a credit. So what's the incentive to buy a cleaner truck? I'm not talking about large transportation trucks. There is no impetus in that bill to incentivize you to buy another truck. It's a meaningless bill. It was just designed to take money out of the general budget and put it in T. Boone Pickens' hands. And if it passes, I would be extremely shocked, to be honest.
All right. So you're saying people who already have, let's say, natural gas-powered vehicles or running CNG, that they would get a credit now? Is that what you're saying if this passed?
Yeah, no, it doesn't have to. That's the whole point. It doesn't have to be a CNG vehicle. It can. People have a very strong misunderstanding of what this bill is actually doing, this proposition. If you have a truck that meets current standards, drive your truck, you get a credit. And there doesn't say anything in the bill that you have to buy a natural gas-producing truck.
Okay, so you're saying everybody who owns a vehicle gets a credit?
No, I'm not following you. I'm talking about commercial trucks. I'm not talking about
every commercial truck gets a credit? That doesn't make sense.
Read the wording of the proposition.
Okay, Scott. Okay, Tracy Weston. That just I don't see how that could possibly be.
I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I just don't know one way or the other. I've heard that argument. I've also heard from the environmental groups that although the measure says it gives tax credits for a whole range of alternative fuel vehicles, natural gas, hybrids, electric, and so forth, they fear that it's slanted, so to speak, to emphasize natural gas. Again, I have not read the specific language, so I couldn't say one way or the other.
Okay, I'm going back to the Proposition 10 and the summary in the California Voter Guide. It says provides nearly $3.5 billion to help consumers and others purchase certain high fuel economy or alternative fuel vehicles, provides $1.25 billion for research, development, production of renewable energy, provides grants to cities for renewable energy, total funding provided $5 billion from general obligation bonds. We'll continue with more propositions on the California ballot. We'll get into local measures as well. And we're taking your calls at 866-893-KPCC. This is Air Talk.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the California Endowment, working to improve the health and healthcare of California's diverse communities. At the California Endowment, community matters.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Dance at the Music Center, presenting the holiday classic The Nutcracker, performed by the Kirov Ballet of the Mariinsky Theater and accompanied by the Kirov Orchestra. This fairy tale ballet is a family tradition to celebrate the festive holiday season. 6 performances only, December 17th through the 20th at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com, information at MusicCenter.org. A record 17 million plus Californians have registered to vote in this this election. Political experts are expecting a record number of them to cast ballots. That means the pressure is on for poll workers. KPECC's special correspondent Kitty Feldy, who will work the polls again this election, spoke with a veteran about tomorrow's.
Zelda James has worked as a poll worker for 10 years. Indications are that she'll be very busy tomorrow. Is she nervous?
A little, yes. It's going to be similar to the recall election, I think, with a little few more people around. But I'm ready. Anxious.
For a poll worker, what does a large turnout mean? I mean, how hard does that make your job?
Easy. The more people who vote, the easier my job is. Because I'm not sitting around being bored all day long.
You can do your part to keep Zelda from getting bored. Polls are open election day from 7 in the morning till 8 at night. Kitty Feldy, 89.3 KPCC.
Well, the weather has definitely changed. It's going to be partly cloudy today, and those clouds will get heavier tonight with a good chance of rain right through tomorrow morning. Temperatures mostly in the 60s. It's 11:41 at KPCC.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. If you'd like to see some 60-second videos that are designed to explain each of California's November ballot measures, you can go to the website cgs.org. That's the Center for Governmental Studies, and they have these voter minutes that help explain the ballot proposition. So in case you tuned in late, of course, you can go to our website, kpcc.org, for explanations on the ballot measures and podcasts of this program or others that have gotten into debates on the ballot measures. Tracy Weston is the CEO of the Center for Governmental Studies. He's our expert answering questions about the measures. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. We have a listener, Paul, who blogged to kpecc.org, that he'd really like to know how bonds are paid for, how bonds work. Tracy, you were showing me in the state voter guide on page 78 and 79, a very thorough explanation,
right.
Even a little graph here to show how bonds work.
Right. And take a look at that. It's very clear and very good. But in a nutshell, the state, let's say, if it wants to sell $10 billion of bonds, it will say, all right, we will sell $10 billion of bonds. Who wants them? Large institutions buy them. The state then raises the $10 billion and then pays the money back with 5% interest over usually 30 years. So it's almost as though the public is lending the state the money. The state gets it up front in one chunk, and they can then invest in infrastructure. And individuals would invest in that because it's a very secure place to put your money. It's backed by the state of California. So that's how they raise money for big infrastructure projects.
And it costs, generally, it looks like the rule of thumb, according to the State Legislative Analyst Office, it's about 2-to-1 once you factor the interest in.
Right.
You're generally, over time, paying about twice the cost of the bond.
That's right. So if the state sells $10 billion in bonds over 30 years, it will cost the state $20 billion.
All right, very good. Well, let's move on to Proposition 11. This is yet another effort to change the way that districts are chosen for state legislative offices and the Board of Equalization in California. This would not affect congressional races. They are exempted in this proposed constitutional amendment, which would establish a panel to determine the boundaries instead of the dominant party in the state legislature that currently does it.
Yes, and in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I, at Center for Governmental Studies, did participate in discussions in the drafting of Proposition 11, but I'll try and be objective as possible here. Yes, that's right. Essentially, redistricting up to now has been handled by the state legislature, approved by the governor. The argument has been that it's an inherent conflict of interest. The legislature is more interested in protecting incumbencies or advancing the interest of their parties instead of keeping communities together. And so this would transfer power over redistricting to an independent commission. Now, the independent commission, as you said, would only redistrict state legislative districts. The legislature would still redistrict congressional districts. The opponents argue that this is a very complicated Rube Goldberg scheme, and it is more complicated than the current one, which just lets the legislature do it. People volunteer for this commission. State auditors then pick 60. Legislative leaders veto 24. Then the remaining 36 are gone through a lottery and 8 are picked and they pick the remaining 14. So it does take a little time to go through this. It does require, however, that the independent commission contain 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and 4 independents of neither party. And the final plans have to be approved by a supermajority of 9 out of 14, with 3 Democrats, 3 Republicans, and 3 independents all voting for it. So it has to be a consensus document.
All right. That is Proposition 11 on your California ballot that would call for this panel to do redistricting instead of the legislature. And the final ballot measure is Proposition 12. This extends an already existing military veterans housing program, but provides more money through bond issuance to fund it.
That's right. This has been done 26 times in California's past, so this is not something that's new. For years and years, the state of California has helped veterans purchase homes, trailers, even farms. It costs $900 million in selling these bonds, but the proponents argue the vets always pay it back. So historically, the state has never lost money. In fact, it's actually made a little money, and the money has covered the administrative costs. So it's a good thing to do to honor the vets, and it doesn't cost the state anything over the long term. The arguments against it are essentially taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing this, and some opponents say that it should be limited to vets who have served in combat. Proponents rebut, well, when you join the military, you don't know if you're going to end up in combat. We need to honor your service in any event. This was put on the ballot unanimously by both houses of the legislature. There was not a single dissent.
All right. So those are the state ballot measures. We'll take calls if you have questions about any of them before we move on to the local measures. 866-893-5722. Joan from Mid-City, Los Angeles, on the Air Talk blog, says there should be more information about the Superior Court judges on the ballot, a statement by them. I just want to call your attention to the fact that for some of the candidates, they did file a statement that is in your sample ballot. It's right after you go through the arguments for your local, or I'm sorry, right before the arguments for your local propositions, you'll see the statements by some of the judges, although don't they pay to have this put in the guide?
Yes.
So it's only the ones that have the resources to pay for it. But for example, Stephen Simons in office number 72, Cynthia Liu and Thomas Rubinson on office number 82, they have statements in the sample ballot for Los Angeles County.
And you can also go to the L.A. County Bar Association that reviews all of the judges and gives you a sense of how well qualified they are. So there is that independent source. LA Times reviews and interviews all of the judges. They usually publish their recommendations. But it is difficult. I'm an attorney. I don't know who these candidates are. I have to talk to friends and go to the Bar Association.
Yeah, and some things like temperament, they may be very well qualified, but right, you don't necessarily know their judicial temperament without having met them. Caleb is in the area of USC. Good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Go right ahead, sir.
I just have a question about Proposition 8. I think it's a pretty straightforward, civil rights issue, and I want to vote no on it. My only concern is that if it doesn't pass, that faith-based organizations like churches would then be forced to conduct marriages that they don't believe in. And how likely do you think that would be that we would see maybe lawsuits brought against churches that refuse to conduct marriages of that they don't support?
Sure. Well, it's a very good question, because we have the Unruh law in California that pertains to private businesses, that they are not allowed to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. But would churches be subject to that? Does having same-sex marriage legal change that?
No, as I understand it, that would not happen. Churches are still considered private, and there's no requirement that I know of that would force them to perform same-sex marriages. So that seems to be not an issue. Now, with respect to municipal facilities or government facilities or justices of the peace, it might require them to. And there have been some cases already about that in which some justices of the peace said they don't want to do it. It violates their personal convictions. And courts have said, no, as long as you're a government employee, you have to be neutral. But as I understand it, this does not apply to private churches, and it would not require them to perform same-sex marriages if that contradicted their own principles.
We saw this play out in the private sector with a fertility clinic, I believe it was, that didn't want to do the assistive reproductive right. technique with a lesbian couple, as I recall, referred them to someone else, and the lesbian couple sued
right.
For discrimination and were successful in that lawsuit.
Again, the government can't discriminate, but private individuals have the right to follow their own conscience. So I don't have to let anyone into my home for dinner, but if I'm running a government restaurant, I can't discriminate.
Or a private restaurant, you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation.
It's based on statute, yeah. And it's not been applied to the churches.
Okay. Caleb, thank you very much. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. Jay in Sherman Oaks, welcome. Your thoughts on tomorrow's ballot.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm one of your biggest fans.
Thank you, Jay.
I'm wondering if either of you could speak to the general problem that we're having with propositions in California these days. Prop 8 is one of the only really clear ones where the voters have a chance to express their will. But there are so many other issues where people are so divided, even who would normally be in the same constituencies. And I'm just wondering if there's any way that we can vet propositions a little better so that when you're voting on something, you can actually understand what you're voting for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Center for Governmental Studies has just published a book on this called Democracy by Initiative. It's a very difficult question you're asking. The initiative process in California is now almost 100 years old. It was adopted in 1911. It's grown enormously in importance. In the 1960s, for instance, the whole decade, there were only 9 initiatives on the ballot. In the 2000s, there were 63. So you can see we're increasingly running the state by initiative. And these initiatives are often very complicated, very hard to read, lots of ambiguities, differences in interpretation. Now, Florida has an interesting system. They have the Supreme Court review the initiative for constitutionality as it's being circulated. I think it has to get 20% of the signatures required, and then it goes to the court. That would be difficult to do in California because there's so many initiatives that are being circulated. 63 in the decade got on the ballot, but many more have been circulated that didn't reach the ballot. So that might overload the Supreme Court.
Well, it would theoretically make it a much more expensive process, right? Because if the petitioner had to pay for that, and presumably they would have to pay an administrative fee if you're going to have judges review it, then the argument could be that disenfranchises causes that don't have the financial resources.
I think the key here is to improve voter information. Now, the Secretary of State puts out a very good and very detailed ballot pamphlet, but it's so detailed that most people have trouble reading all of it. So the Secretary of State needs to simplify the information. For instance, it might have a page in which proponents and opponents could simply list their endorsers. So you could get a quick gestalt view of who's for it, who's against it. They might list all of the editorial board opinions in the state if you think those are persuasive.
If that could be done by time of publication of the guide.
And the guide could be online, and so it could be updated very recently. We think increasingly video ought to be used, and short voter minutes ought to be put on YouTube and so forth. And also, we think there are ways of reducing the number of initiatives on the ballot by letting the proponent withdraw it if the legislature adopts an acceptable compromise. That would then engage the legislature again, and some measures would fall off the ballot simply because they reached a deal. So there are ways of reducing the numbers, increasing legislative involvement, providing greater voter information. But what does not seem to be in the cards is eliminating the initiative process. And any time you propose that to the public, they strongly resist. Right now, the initiative process has about 75% to 80% confidence from the public, whereas the state legislature is down around 20%.
Talking with Tracy Weston, CEO of the Center for Governmental Studies. Let's talk about Los Angeles County's Measure R, because this is a half-cent sales tax increase that is proposed. It requires a two-thirds support for passage because it is a sales tax increase. The money would go to a variety of projects, including light rail, as well as a potential subway to the sea, the Purple Line that would be extended. There is some regional discord over Measure R.
Yes, some of the county supervisors are against that. I think off the record it's because they feel that their areas of the county aren't getting enough of this money.
Mm-hmm, yes.
But it does purport to be a comprehensive transportation plan for Los Angeles. It deals with light rail. It deals with buses. It improves synchronization of traffic lights. It fixes bridges, potholes, keeps fares low for students, seniors. They also argue it creates 200,000 new jobs, and the cost ultimately is about $25 a year per person, which is half of one tank of gas. So it's an attempt to begin to grapple with L.A. County's transportation traffic problems in a more comprehensive manner. Whether the money will be distributed evenly among all of the parts of the county probably won't. Probably because they don't all have the same traffic problems.
Well, the folks in the eastern part of L.A. County argue they have some of the most congested places in the county for traffic and are not getting a proportional funding out of this, even though everybody's going to be taxed for it. And then the question is what you're going to see from those voters in areas other than the west side of Los Angeles, where there seems to be quite strong support for the subway construction at this point. Laura, in Burbank, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, hi, Larry. I just wanted to quickly mention that for people who aren't interested in the qualifications of the judges, as your guest had mentioned, the County Bar Association, LA County, does review them, but they're available to all members of the public, and all you have to do to find out about the various candidates in terms of whether they're unqualified, qualified, or very qualified is to go on to lacba.org. And then just do a search for the ratings. And I believe they do it in tandem with the League of Women Voters. Okay?
Yeah, of course, one of the seats you've got, neither one rated as qualified. So that's you're on your own, I guess, there. Yep. Laura, thank you very much. We appreciate you sharing that information with us. We just have a couple of minutes to go. And so just want to wrap up with Los Angeles City. There is this Measure A that is a big anti-gang after-school program. It would be a parcel tax that would fund Los Angeles's Measure A. And it, too, requires a two-thirds threshold. I think this is going to be tough for these measures when you look at the economic downturn.
Yeah. The budget crisis is very much in everyone's mind. And it might be possible to get a simple majority, but getting a two-thirds majority is very, very difficult, even in good economic times. This will impose a $36 a year tax on each piece of property. The money is supposed to go into gang prevention, after-school job training programs. Focuses on youth at risk. It tries to get them out of gangs and into after-school programs. It's all well-motivated. It's supported by Police Chief Bratton, Sheriff Baca. They think it will reduce gang violence. It's opposed by City Controller Laura Chick, who said, look, the problem here is not a lack of money. It's a lack of management. We have too many programs scattered and uncoordinated, and somebody ought to sit down and integrate them all together. The LA Times actually is somewhat critical of this as well, saying it's going to undermine city program oversight over contracts. So there's a dispute, not as to the existence of the gang problem, but there's a dispute over how well this money will be spent.
All right. There are a number of development measures in cities like Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, Seal Beach that you'll be able to decide tomorrow. Many school bond measures that if you live within those public districts, you'll be deciding on as well. Please visit our website, kpcc.org, for more information. Also, cgs.org, the Center for Governmental Studies, has all of the state measures from your ballot with little 60-second videos that explain the pros and cons of them straight down the middle of approach. Tracy Weston, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate it. He's the CEO of the Center for Governmental Studies, and his colleague Bob Stern will be on with Pat Morrison with an election primer coming up at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. Programming.